This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 169, A New Alexander. Last time, I covered Antiochus III's war with King Xerxes of Sophene and the annexation of his western Armenian sub-kingdom into Seleucid hands. I also covered a bit of the Hellenistic history of Armenia and its various kings, territorial divisions, and political shifts. But now it's time for the Anabasis of Antiochus to continue. After defeating Xerxes, Antiochus III and the Seleucid royal army began marching east to make a second attempt at reconquering the separatist kingdoms of Parthia and Bactria. Antiochus's father, Seleucus II Callinicus, had tried and failed in this task almost 20 years earlier. In 209 BCE, Antiochus's forces marched out from northern Media and into the territory of the Parthian kingdom. There they clashed repeatedly with the army of the Parthian king, Arsaces II, chasing them across northern Iran until a final, gruesome siege of the city of Syrinx in Hyrcania. After capturing Syrinx, Antiochus allowed Arsaces to remain in at least partial control of his kingdom as a Seleucid vassal, forced to contribute funds and manpower to the royal army that had just defeated him as they prepared for their next war of reconquest in the recently established Greco-Bactrian kingdom. Unfortunately, we know very little about this kingdom at any point in its history, largely piecing the story together through the coinage of its rulers and scant abbreviated accounts in more Western sources focused on later events. Evidently, Polybius's histories originally contained a larger account of Antiochus III's Bactrian campaign, but most of that has been lost, so we are forced to settle with what the fragmentary summaries can tell us. We know that the original secessionist was Diodorus I, the Seleucid satrap of Bactria, who became functionally independent in the years while Seleucus II was fighting against his younger brother in Anatolia. And the Diodotid dynasty managed to last for most of a generation. Diodorus II inherited his father's position and openly claimed the title of king for the first time. But shortly before Antiochus III began his eastward march, Diodotus was overthrown by Euthydemus of Magnesia. This new monarch was an Anatolian Greek who had evidently acquired some level of political power in the region. He may have come as a mercenary, or been the son of a Seleucid official, or had some other background entirely, we just don't know. All we can really say is that Euthydemus staged a coup and claimed the Bactrian throne for himself. This places Bactria in an interesting contrast to Parthia at the same time period. While both began their journeys as independent kingdoms under breakaway Seleucid satraps, Parthia quickly fell to the nomadic Parni of Arsaces I and emerged as a distinctly Iranian kingdom, trying to find its place in a time and world dominated by Hellenism. Bactria, on the other hand, remained firmly in the grip of the Greco-Macedonian ruling class established by Alexander the Great. Yet it was also so far away from the imperial core, so deep in the Iranian world, that it was the primary route out of Iran and into the steppe or India. Over time, both Parthia and the Greco-Bactrian kingdom developed their own syntheses of Greek and Iranian culture in their artwork, iconography, and religion. However, where Parthia was largely driven by Iranian rulers trying to incorporate themselves into a Greek power structure, Bactria was that Greek power structure attempting to solidify itself in an Iranian environment. Given the fragmentary nature of our primary source for today's conflict, we do not get off to a great start. Polybios says that Euthydemus marshaled his army at Tapuria, a city which Strabo reported would not be founded until decades after this episode took place, when a nomadic tribe called the Tapurii settled there. Given how often ancient city foundations were actually just renaming an older site, I am tempted to guess that Euthydemus gathered at the future location of Tapuria, whatever it happened to be called at the time. This whole incident is a bit confusing, at least as the story has come down through the centuries. Polybius says that Antiochus was already engaged in a siege somewhere nearby when he heard that Euthydemus was marshaling forces at Tapuria to block a crossing on the Arius River. That is the modern Hari River in Afghanistan. By most modern accounts, this should have been at the edge of Bactrian territory. So whether Antiochus was already besieging a Bactrian city, an independent enemy, or some sort of final Parthian holdout is hard to say. Regardless, the Seleucid army broke off this siege to confront Euthydemus and capture Tapuria. Like many Iranian states in antiquity, the Bactrian military was heavily dependent on cavalry, and Euthydemus held the crossing with 10,000 horsemen. To counter this, Antiochus raced ahead of his heavier phalanx with the Seleucid cavalry and light infantry for 3 days to reach Tapuria. During daylight hours, Euthydemus and his troops would cross the river and stand guard. But they crossed back to sleep in the city at night. So Antiochus decided to move under cover of darkness. He took the bulk of the army across the Arius at night, surprising the Bactrian scouts the next morning, who rode back to Tapuria, informing their king that the Seleucid army was suddenly on their side of the river, and their blockade had failed. most of the Seleucid forces formed up in their usual ranks, just without the phalanx. So cavalry on the ends and light infantry in between. But Antiochus himself gathered 1,000 of his own horsemen to form a vanguard, and personally led the first countercharge against the Bactrians when they attacked shortly after daybreak. This royal cavalry squadron successfully repelled the first Bactrian charge, but were quickly overwhelmed by successive waves of enemy riders. So the light infantry and cavalry flanks were ordered to move in and rescue the king. This was successful, although both armies suffered severe casualties, including Antiochus himself. In the mounted melee that followed the third Bactrian cavalry charge, Antiochus III was hit with a glancing blow in the mouth, cutting his face and knocking out several teeth. The royal horse was even more unlucky, and Antiochus's personal mount was killed in the fighting, meaning that, at least briefly, he was forced to fight on foot while his reinforcements regained control of the battlefield. Despite some setbacks, the Battle of the Arius was still a Seleucid victory, and Euthydemus was forced to retreat, ceding Tapuria to Antiochus's control, while he and his army fled back to their capital at Bactra. Presumably, the Seleucids spent at least a few days at Tapuria to take control of the city, let the king recuperate, and wait for the main phalanx to catch up. But at this point, we lose track of the Seleucid-Bactrian War for about 2 years. Much like the fragmentary account of Antiochus's reconquest of Anatolia, we only have the beginning and the end of the story. We don't know what action, if any, happened across the rest of Bactria. But at least part of the Seleucid army spent most of those 2 years between 208 and 206 laying siege to Bactra itself. At some point toward the end of the siege, Euthydemus opened up negotiations with Antiochus and offered a creative solution. Despite resisting Seleucid conquest for years, Euthydemus claimed that he was not a rebel. Neither he nor his ancestors had rebelled against Seleucid control. In fact, Euthydemus argued, he was the one who deposed the rebel king Diodotus. Of course, you can probably imagine that this wasn't an especially convincing argument to Antiochus, but it also wasn't the only factor putting pressure on the negotiations by the spring of 206. According to Polybius, a large force of nomads from the northern steppe had crossed into Bactria around this time, and presented a threat to Antiochus and Euthydemus alike. Modern historians are split on whether these were allies of the Bactrians, who only threatened Euthydemus if he couldn't pay them, or if they were a third party entering the conflict. That said, I think Polybius's account is fairly clear that they were a third party taking advantage of the war to raid and pillage. So Antiochus offered the same favorable terms he had been offering to most of the kingdoms established before he took power. Euthydemus and the Bactrian kingdom would become a Seleucid vassal, retain the royal title and a degree of local autonomy, and they would supply money and soldiers in exchange. Euthydemus took the deal and sent his son, Prince Demetrius, to sign an agreement with Antiochus. Demetrius made a very good impression on his new overlord, so much so that Antiochus offered to sweeten the deal and make the Greco-Bactrian prince a marriage pact. Antiochus's daughter, Laodike, was summoned to marry Demetrius, both strengthening their agreement and trying to ensure that the treaty would last for another generation. Whatever threat the invading nomads posed, though, Antiochus decided it wasn't his personal problem anymore after the treaty was signed. He left Euthydemus and Demetrius to defend their own frontier, but the Seleucid army did not turn around, even though they had now defeated all of the rebels that had stood against Antiochus III. Instead, they continued east, marching into the peaks of the Hindu Kush Mountains, the first Hellenistic army to do so in almost 130 years since the campaigns of Alexander the Great. Now, Antiochus's march into quote-unquote India comes with a caveat. He did not reach modern Pakistan or any part of what we usually consider the Indian subcontinent. Rather, he entered the remnants of the territory Alexander had labeled as Parapamisadai, surrounding modern Kabul, Afghanistan. This region, along with much of Afghanistan and eastern Iran, had been ceded to the Mauryan Empire by Seleucus Nicator all the way back at the beginning of the Seleucid Empire. But the politics of the region had shifted in recent decades. By the time Antiochus reached Indian territory, the Mauryans were well into their decline under the leadership of Shalishuka Maurya, described in the Yuga Purana as, quote, cheerful-minded yet fond of conflict, an oppressor of his own kingdom, of righteous speech but unrighteous conduct. If you remember my discussion of late Mauryan history back in episode 161, this was after the empire began to fragment in the wake of Ashoka Maurya's death and disputed succession. They had seen a brief renaissance under Shalishuka's predecessor, but when Shalishuka himself took power in a coup around 215 BCE, Mauryan power began to shatter in earnest. At some point in all of this, Sophagasinus, probably known as Subhagasena in Sanskrit, became an independent ruler of Parapamisadai. By the time Antiochus arrived in person, he had already submitted to some sort of alliance with the Seleucids. We don't know when this happened. All that remains of Polybius's history have to say is that Antiochus renewed this alliance when they met in person. Personally, I hypothesize that this alliance emerged out of the Bactrian conflict, either shortly before Antiochus's march east or in those missing years between the Battle of the Arius and the Siege of Bactra. Either way, Sophagasinus was clearly subservient in this new relationship, because one of the primary reasons for Antiochus's visit was to collect dozens of Indian elephants that the Indian king had prepared to give off to the Seleucid army. This raised the traveling Seleucid elephant corps to 150 war beasts, and Sophagasinus had also apparently agreed to pay such a large amount of tribute that he wasn't even able to collect it all before Antiochus had to depart. So a Seleucid representative was left behind in Parapamisadai to collect Sophagasinus's remaining payment before returning home. While Polybius calls this an alliance, it's pretty clearly an alliance under similar terms to Bactria, Parthia, Sophene, and Atropatene. Nominal independence in exchange for submission to Antiochus. But this moment of Antiochus's departure from Sophagasinus's court is where the story gets most interesting to me. And of course, that means it's the part where we get fewer and fewer details from Polybius. From Parapamisidae, Antiochus III and his army, now including an impressive retinue of elephants, marched south into Arachosia, which, like Parapamisidae, hadn't seen Seleucid rule in a century. Most unfortunately, we know nothing about Arachosian politics, or really Arachosia in general, in the 3rd century BCE. By this time, the region had certainly fallen out of Morian hands, but we have no indication whose hands it was actually in. It may have been its own kingdom, a subkingdom of Sophagasenus, a collection of minor kingdoms. We just don't know. Polybius doesn't mention any conflict there, but the surviving documents barely describe the last 4 wars, so skipping over some minor battles doesn't mean much. It is thus entirely possible that, like Alexander on his journey north, Antiochus conquered his way south back to his own territory, or simply accepted submission along the way. Regardless, it is clear that under Antiochus III, Arachosia too has returned to the Seleucid fold. From there, Antiochus made sure his army was well stocked with extra provisions and began the long trek back across Iran. He learned from Alexander the Great's mistakes and stopped before reaching the Gedrosian Desert in modern Balochistan. Instead, he cut across Drangiana in central Iran to reach the coastal territory of Karmania on the northeastern shore of the Persian Gulf. Then he made his way back toward Antioch in Persis following a winter spent in Karmania, continuing their journey up the coast. From here, the narrative gets even more confusing. The fragmented summary of Polybius I've been using since the Battle of the Arius more or less stops after leaving Karmania. But we know from other records that Antiochus received emissaries from Magnesia on the Maeander all the way back in Anatolia while he was in Persis. We know he approved royal sponsorship for a new festival of the goddess Artemis in their city. And another section of Polybius' histories includes some fascinating further escapades from the Anabasis of Antiochus before he returned to Syria. The Magnesian envoys traveled with the king as far as Alexandria. Of course, there were many, many cities with that name, but geographically, the most likely one is the Mesopotamian Alexandria on the ever-shifting banks of the Shatt al-Arab. This is the short river forged by the merging of the Tigris and Euphrates before they reach the Persian Gulf. Most of our evidence for Seleucid activity in the Gulf comes from decades after Antiochus III's visit. But by that point, it's also clear that the Seleucid presence was well established. Undoubtedly, at least some of this presence predates Antiochus too. It would be absurd to imagine that his predecessors ignored this immensely valuable maritime trade route entirely. But we do not know the exact sequence of development. By the mid-2nd century BCE, Seleucid naval bases and forts were all over several of the largest islands, including Karg Island of modern Iranian oil refinery fame. However, Antiochus did not limit his time to the modern Iranian side of the Persian Gulf. According to Polybius, the king and a portion of the Seleucid army traveled to the Arabian side to expand their influence. You may remember that this was supposedly Alexander the Great's last unachieved plan for conquest before his death. From Alexandria, Antiochus sailed out into the Persian Gulf and headed for Gerha, somewhere on the eastern Arabian coast, either near modern Hofuf or Jubail. Calling the Gerhaeans and their neighbors in eastern Arabia at this time Arabs is a little misleading. Geographically, it's obviously correct, but the Arabic language as we know it today was still just starting to take shape. And modern Arabic is largely derived from the dialect spoken on the other side of the peninsula. The languages of most of Arabia at this time are broadly described as Central Semitic, although the region of Gerha in particular is associated with a specific form called Hasaidic. Regardless, Gerha in the Seleucid period controlled a large enough swath of territory to have been administered in several distinct districts, and they all grew wealthy on the trade of incense, spices, and salt, both harvested locally and traded by land and sea with the rest of Arabia. Though there was no battle here, negotiations between the Seleucids and Gerhaeans resulted in a massive payment of tribute before the king moved on, sailing even further south to the land the Greeks knew as Tilos, and you and I know better today as Bahrain. Modern Bahrain is an island, and the kingdom that rules that island and the smaller archipelago surrounding it. Historically, the borders associated with the island of Bahrain fluctuated quite a bit, at times limited to the main island itself, and at other times encompassing a large swath of mainland Arabia. For the purpose of Hellenistic Tilos, let's just focus on the main island. Bahrain is one of those places that occasionally dot the world, which can't help but become wealthy and important. The modern tourism and financial industries are built over the economic scaffold of 20th century oil wealth, which does remain an important part of the modern economy. However, with a strategic position in the Persian Gulf, but geographically separated from the mainland, the island has been an economic hub of trade and commerce since the dawn of recorded history. Initially growing prosperous as a connecting point for spices, incense, and luxury goods flowing between the Persian Gulf, the Indian Ocean, and the Red Sea, as well as Arabian desert caravans. The island was first documented as a trade hub called Dilmun in the 4th millennium BCE, and reached its peak as the seat of an independent kingdom between 2000 and 1600 BC. At other times, it was conquered and ruled by Mesopotamian empires. And just for some historical context, around 1800 BCE, a certain copper merchant from the Mesopotamian city of Ur, who went by the name Ea Nasir, was likely in Dilmun when several of his customers sent their famous complaint letters about his substandard copper. By the Achaemenid period, it's highly likely that the modern island of Bahrain was incorporated into the Achaemenid satrapy of Makkah, which also included most of the modern United Arab Emirates and northeastern Oman. We don't know what exactly Antiochus III did when he traveled to the island he knew as Tilos, aside from collecting a shipment of rare spices. Given his activity in Gerha, it seems possible that he traveled to the famously wealthy island to collect tribute and submission from another potential vassal. There is some archaeological evidence to support this, with a possible Seleucid naval base at Kalat al-Bahrain, a point on the northern end of the island that hosted imperial presence repeatedly throughout its history, going all the way back to the Kassite Babylonians of the Bronze Age and down to the Portuguese colonial empire of the 16th century CE. About 70 years after Antiochus's visit, we have firm evidence in the form of a strategos, the Greek word for general, that Seleucids often used as a regional governor's title, ruling over Tylos and the surrounding islands. By that time, the office of strategos was already an established position on the island, so it stands to reason that it was implemented at some earlier point, quite probably under Antiochus's rule. If this were the case, then Antiochus could truly claim to have done what Alexander could not. He visited India, returned with relative ease, and expanded Hellenistic rule into Arabia. It is in this context, Antiochus III's reconquest of Bactria, Indo-Iran, and expedition into the Persian Gulf, that Polybios wrote that it was this expedition, in fact, which made him appear worthy of his throne, not only to the inhabitants of Asia, but those of Europe likewise. Though the ancient historian doesn't say it explicitly, many modern historians have taken this line to mean that this was the event where Antiochus III earned his epithet. His ancestors had claimed many lofty titles: Seleucus the Victor, Antiochus the Savior, Seleucus the Beautifully Victorious, Antiochus the God. Yet none of them were ever remembered in quite the same way as Antiochus Megas, Antiochus the Great. And yet, there's never any rest for a great ancient conqueror. From Tylos, Antiochus the Great returned to Seleucia on the Tigris, and from there to Antioch and the Seleucids of Syria. On his journey home, Antiochus would have received word of political chaos in Egypt, as his former rival, Ptolemy IV, had died unexpectedly and passed the throne to his infant son, the newly crowned Ptolemy V, under a series of squabbling regents who vied for power in the first few years of Ptolemy's infantile rule over Egypt. With Ptolemy IV dead, any treaties the late pharaoh had made died with him, including his pact with Antiochus following the Battle of Raphia and the Fourth Syrian War. Egypt was now vulnerable, in chaos, and Antiochus had a free hand to make a second attempt at reclaiming not only all of the territory once ruled by Seleucus Nicator, and not only the new lands in Arabia, but all of the territory his ancestors had ever laid claim to in Coel Syria. But that is a story for a later episode. Next time we will discuss the one region of the Seleucid Empire I haven't really had the chance to deal with under Antiochus III, Mesopotamia, and the satrapies of Babylon and Assyria. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.